for some prayer for Andrew Weitzel, who is suffering from a second bout with strep. If you would please keep him in prayer. Although it is a pleasure to hear him so quiet. Nothing, huh? That was sort of funny. Apparently not. Okay. This is the first of two messages on Shavuot. Obviously, next week I will be speaking on Shavuot or Pentecost again. And I want to prepare us for this season, for it is possibly the most profound season that God gave to his people. Last week I mentioned a couple of consequences of being created in the image of God. First, we are able to reason. We are reasonable creatures. We can think logically. We can deduce things. We have even come up with words for it, a syllogism. We take fact A, add it to fact B, and we come up with a conclusion. Now, that conclusion may be right or wrong based on information, but that is our ability to reason. Being created in the image of the Creator, we have to create. We don't create in the same fashion. We don't make stuff out of nothing. But we are continually manipulating God's creation. We never leave our environment alone. It is one of the more pressing issues for the environmentalists who declare that we should be more natural creatures. We are. This is our nature. We cannot leave things alone. We have to manipulate. One of the reasons is we wouldn't survive without it. It's how we survive. We don't have weapon systems like other animals. We're not fleet of foot. We can't fly. And so we have to manipulate our environment, and we're the only creatures that do that to the extent that we see. Now, sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad. But we must. It is in our souls, it is in our nature to change things around us. You're wearing clothing, for instance. You're sitting on chairs, the carpet you're walking on. None of these things is found in nature. There is no beast called Naugahyde from which we get skin. There is not a polyester that produces fine woven threads that we can turn into material. These are things that we make out of other things. I also spoke on the soul as being synonymous with the concept of awareness. It is my soul that makes me aware of my surroundings. My animal soul, the nefesh, the soul I share with all other animal creatures, is aware of the physical reality and seeks to preserve this body. Fight or flight, regulate body temperature. All of these things are in the realm and under the purview of the nefesh. The neshama has the same function, but only in the spiritual realm. The word neshama means breath. Neshama chaya, the breath of life that was breathed into a man and he became a living soul. A neshama. That breath of God. I want to put two other words into relationship before I begin or before I continue with this message. And those words are knowledge and understanding. Knowledge equals information, facts. Nothing more, nothing less. To have a knowledge of something is to know it, to realize it exists. Understanding equates to the whys that it exists, how it functions, why it exists. Primarily, knowledge is accumulated through empirical means. our senses take in what is around us, and we have a knowledge of our surroundings. Understanding is more a function of the mind, which is ever seeking to understand how things work. What we do with that either results in wisdom or folly. Knowledge does not necessarily equate to wisdom, nor does understanding. My favorite example, my mother told me not to stick the fork in the outlet. That's knowledge. As I grew older, I began to understand why. Negative electrons flow to a ground. If you're in the middle of that, they will flow through you, and you have electrical impulses in you that will be disrupted. And the higher the voltage and the greater the amperage, the greater the disruption. But that didn't stop me from sticking the fork in the outlet. Because my mother was never right. Now, yesterday I found out, it was revealed to me, a rather disturbing truth. When I asked how many people have stuck the fork in the outlet? 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, there were 3 last night. I thought everybody had at some point stuck the fork in the outlet. And I was completely shocked and dismayed to find out that I am in this small minority of lunatics who, having received knowledge and understanding, stuck the fork in there anyway. I don't recommend it if you're young and are thinking about this particular experiment. I have another example which serves to give us some understanding. It's been raining a lot. That's a fact. We can observe it. We can see it. We can feel it. When the thunder and the lightnings come, we can even smell it. The ionized air. Understanding relates to why it is raining. We have relative humidity, how much moisture compared to how much air we have. You add that to particulate matter in the air. And as the temperature gets a little cooler, moisture condensates around this particulate matter, and water precipitates out of the air and forms droplets around these particles, which is why when it rains and the water evaporates, your car is covered with dust. You have to wash it. That knowledge and that understanding gives us the ability to predict what will happen when Mount St. Helens blows its top. There's more particulate matter in the air, and that should logically relate to more rain, bringing the ash down to earth. Now we can make some further predictions, and people did. Some predicted that this huge quantity of ash that would be brought down to the earth would choke the soil and it would kill the crops, and there would be no crops in Washington State, especially to the east. Prevailing winds were blowing the ash that way. Others predicted that this ash is rich in nutrients, which will be dissolved by the rain, and when they come down, will fertilize the soil, and there will be bumper crops. Same information, the same knowledge, the same understanding, 2 completely different predictions. The latter was correct. The next year, there was a huge crop, bumper crop of apples, and some of them were as big as cantaloupes. There are pictures of men holding these apples, and they look like cantaloupes. That's how large they are. The more knowledge and the more understanding we have, certainly the more likely we are to make corrections. So what are these basic observations on reasoning? What do they have to do with our walk with the Lord? They are pivotal. They are essential. Our ability to reason correctly is contingent on our awareness of the conditions that surround us. The carnal man can make decisions based only on the awareness of the nephesh, the animal soul, which perceives this physical world, the empirical senses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch. The spiritual man has additional information. It is just as real, but incapable of being perceived by the carnal senses. His neshama, his breath of God, makes him aware of the one who blew that breath into him, God, who is the beginning of wisdom, we're told. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The addition of God into the calculus of decision-making increases the chances that we are going to make correct decisions. A couple of examples, once again. Moses leads the children of Israel out of Egypt, and he leads them to the Red Sea. Now, on the surface, to those who see with this eye, this is folly. This is an unbelievably bad decision, a strategic blunder. In fact, Israel even started singing. This song is not recorded in Scripture, but I know. It's been revealed to me. Egyptians to the left of me, water to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. We had a lot of trouble. But Moses wasn't walking according to what his natural eyes saw, nor what his natural ears were hearing. He heard God's voice, and that voice gave him additional information. Perhaps the Lord was referring to Moses when he gave the prophet Isaiah words to speak to Israel in chapter 30, verse 20. Your teacher will no longer hide himself. Remember, Moses was referred to Hamoreh, the teacher. Isaiah chapter 30, verse 20, your teacher will no longer hide himself, but your eyes will behold your teacher. Your ears will hear a word behind you. This is the path. Walk in it. Maybe that's what happened to Moses. Moses, the teacher of Moses, walked behind him. Walk this way. Lead the people this way. Moses was aware of the presence of God, and that knowledge caused him to act differently than those who are aware only of their physical surroundings. The natural man would never have counted on the Red Sea opening up. Moses did. Another example in 2 Kings chapter 6, verses 15 through 17. We have a prophet who's been anointed by Elijah, his protege, Elisha. And Elisha has a servant who arises early in the morning to see the city being surrounded by chariots and the armies of the enemies of Israel. He's real afraid. He turns to Elisha and says, "What shall we do?" Elisha's not afraid at all. He says to his servant, "Don't worry about it. Those who are with us are greater than those who are against us." Now, I wasn't there, but I'm pretty sure at this point, Elisha's servant was figuring that he hitched his wagon to the wrong horse. This boy is delusional. He's looking out there, and he sees nothing. No armies. There's nobody else. There's nothing there. I mean, here's reality. There's nothing there. What do you mean there's more with us than with them? That's ridiculous. Look. Elisha doesn't argue. He doesn't try to convince his servant of anything. He turns his eyes towards the heavens and he prays to his Father who is in heaven. Lord, open up the eyes of my servant. Because there's no way to convince his servant of things that are not there. His servant can see. So he prays that his Father in heaven, who gave him eyes to see, would give his servant eyes to see the same thing. Now, the eyes of the servant are opened. Now he too has an awareness of the armies of the Lord and the captain of that host, and his fear is turned to confidence. He's got a little extra hitch in his giddy up, as they say. He's just bopping a little bit. Awareness of our surroundings is crucial to the decisions that we make, and thereby how we are going to behave. And having a spiritual perspective will make us appear strange to those who do not. We're not going to behave the same way because we're not seeing the same things. So we're not going to react in a similar fashion. Where some fear, others will be calm and confident. Paul speaks of these matters. He says, the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are saved, it is the power of God. Without a spiritual eye, without a perspective from the neshama, the soul, the breath of life that was breathed into us, the cross is literally insanity. One man who lived 2,000 years ago gets nailed to a cross and I'm saved? My sins are forgiven? This is absurdity. Nonsense. Mythology. What reasonable individual could believe this? But to those who have had their neshamas refreshed by the holy wind of God, this is the power of God. It is the essence of what our Messiah did, vicarious atonement. One man dying for the sins of many. A prophecy proclaimed by the very high priest who had him killed. It is expedient for one man to die that the nation might live. It is the essence of our faith. To us, it is the power of God. Without that refreshment, without that spiritual perspective, it is profoundly stupid and irrelevant. This is absolutely crucial as we try to negotiate the end of days. If we can see with heaven's eye, you know, our natural senses are easily deceived. A little spiritual prestidigitation and poof, we're all praising God without ever trying the spirits to see if they are from God. Signs and wonders are not the proof that something is from God. We're finishing up the book of Revelation. The devil, the beast, and the false prophets will all produce signs and wonders that will convince many who can fight against the beast. He was dead, now he's alive. Who can make war with him? There are numerous signs and wonders. The Lord said, try them to see if those spirits are from God. Do they line up with my word? Are they telling you to do something that my word tells you not to do? Or are they telling you to not do something that my word commands you to do? If they are, don't follow them. In fact, in Deuteronomy chapter 13, it says, kill the one who tells you. He's a presumptuous prophet and meets the same fate as the false prophet. If we can see with heaven's eye and hear with heaven's ear, we will fare better. More information. In this regard, Shavuot is the most important event in Judaism and for us as believers. Prior to Sinai, Israel was a promise made to one man, Abraham. At Sinai, God declares this in Deuteronomy 27, this day you have become a people to the Lord. This day you have become the fulfillment of the promise that I made to Abraham. Shavuot is also one of the first fruit celebrations in Judaism, We have Omer Reshit, one of the holy days is first fruits, but Shavuot is the first fruit of the spring harvest. And Yom Teruah, the Feast of Trumpets, is the first fruit of the fall harvest. There are actually three first fruit celebrations. And Israel became a kind of first fruit of humanity on the day God appeared and made Israel a people unto the Lord. They became the first fruits of those extracted from humanity and called to be holy and to worship God. They were the first fruits. They wouldn't be the last, but they were the first. Now, Judaism began like most religions begin. There was a revelation to one man, Abraham. And then Abraham spoke with passion about this revelation, and he was able to convince a number of people that the revelation that he received was true. And there were a number of souls that left with Abraham out of Haran and went to Canaan with Abraham. The people who followed had no experiential knowledge. They left and they went with Abraham based on their faith in the experience that he had. Now, on the surface, there is very little difference between this narrative and the narrative followed, for instance, by Islam. What's the difference? God, or Allah, came to one man, Muhammad, and he gave him a revelation, and then that man became the divine repository, the repository of divine knowledge. The same narrative can be applied to virtually all religions. The Mormons, an angel of light came to Joseph Smith and gave him golden tablets and told him to write this book and to speak to people about this revelation. Then, of course, he had to break up the tablets and bury them somewhere because nobody else could see them. Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard, same deal, minus the golden tablets, just words. Christian Science, Mary Baker Eddy, same concept. God comes to one person who is instructed to speak to others, no different than Abraham. Absolutely no difference at all. The revelation is exclusive, meaning that without this new revelation, this new knowledge, one will not receive certain benefits, and those benefits can either be spiritual or physical or a combination of both. For instance, Christian Science is based on the belief that all sickness is an illusion. It's not real. It doesn't really exist. It exists only in your mind. So in essence, it is a mental disease, a mental disorder. And if you can correct your beliefs and you can align them with the Christian Science beliefs, sickness will magically disappear. It's kind of curious that the Word of Faith ministries have borrowed much from Miss Eddy, that sickness is not real. That's why Christian Scientists don't bring their children or themselves to doctors. Doctors only help you be convinced that the sickness is real. What we need to do is adjust our thinking, and then the sickness will disappear like so much mist when the sun hits it. Very similar beliefs with Mr. Hubbard. Our minds control our reality. I don't believe that. There's much about me that my thinking can change. There is much that it cannot. In my mind, I can believe I am a young black woman. But I ain't going to ever get nobody to believe that. Maybe a blind person. There's no credibility to any of these narratives, including Abraham's encounter with God. And the reason is simple. There's no corroboration. There is no way to either prove or disprove the one who, quote, heard God, unquote. And this is why Shavuot is so crucial to our faith. God did not speak to one man, Moshe, who was to bring the word of God in the form of tablets down to Israel. Despite Cecil B. DeMille's depiction of the events at Sinai, which were wrong, God first spoke to all of Israel, and there were some 3 million people there that day. Men, women, children, servants. They all heard God speak. They all saw the cloud and the luminescent presence within that cloud. They all felt the presence of the Lord and were laid low at the base of Sinai. Over 3 million people heard God speak. I am the Lord your God. Have no other gods before me. Moses, come up. It was not Moses who told Israel about God. It was God who told Israel about Moses. This one is your leader. And that differs dramatically. That is the essence of the difference between Judaism and its child, Christianity, and all other religions. There was a national revelation. It wasn't one man to whom God spoke who then used that revelation to get other people to follow him. It was God who spoke and called one man to lead that nation. Prior to that, the Hebrews believed Abraham. Now they heard themselves. It is the absolute essence of the New Covenant portion today. That woman came back and told the Samaritans of the man who had told her of everything she had ever done. And they believed enough of that to come out and see him. And then in their own words, we believed because you spoke, but now we have seen and we have heard, and now we believe. And they were all converted. They all came to faith. There's an old Jewish joke. It's kind of a funny joke, but it's great theology. There's this rabbi. And rabbi has a number of students. One of his students come to him and say, Rabbi, I had the most wonderful vision. In this vision, I was the rabbi of a congregation of 500. And the rabbi smiles and says, Mazel tov, good. Come back and see me when 500 have a vision that you're their rabbi. It's a pretty good joke. But the theology is based on Sinai. It wasn't Moses who had a vision that he was the leader of Israel. It was God who gave to Israel a vision that Moses was their leader. It is essentially different, fundamentally. If I was out in this parking lot right now, or let's say somebody's out in the parking, if I was out in the parking lot, I couldn't be speaking to you, so that's a poor analogy. Somebody comes in and says, there's a flying saucer in the parking lot. Very few of you would look, and you would all move away from him on the bench. Nobody would sit next to him, and hopefully we'd speak in measured terms and measured tones to him, and he would be on his way. If 3 or 4 people came in and said that, you might take a gander outside, but still you wouldn't be convinced. three or four people, there can be collusion to make a lie in order to deceive, to get attention, for whatever reason. But if every one of you were out in that parking lot and saw that flying saucer, nobody would be able to convince you differently. You experienced it. It's real. And it would be part of your life forever. An experience that would change that. Your perspective would no longer be the same. 1,500 years after God spoke at Mount Sinai, God gave another revelation again on Shavuot. And here the holy wind blew on all those who were gathered in that upper room that day. It too was the beginning of a people. Yaakov, James, declares this expressly in chapter 1, verse 18. In the exercise of his will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, so that we would be a kind of first fruits among his creatures. We are different. Those who were in that upper room that day were changed fundamentally. They were a different species. I love to portray it this way. They were no longer Homo sapiens. They were now Homo spiritus. They were spiritual creatures, not carnal. They were no longer tethered to the earth. They now soared on the wings of eagles. They now had access to the throne room itself. They now had ears that could hear the word of God. They had eyes that could see his hand moving in their life. They were different. The holy wind of God refreshed the neshama chaya, the breath of life, of all those who were present. And they saw the world differently. And they were all more aware of the spiritual realm that surrounds them, just as real, but incapable of being understood or seen with these eyes. When I first got down to Denver from Idaho, I started attending some Talmud classes, get refreshed. These are things I studied when I was a child, and into my teens, but it had been a long time. And I don't remember much of those classes because they were not all that good. But there was one thing. The rabbi was speaking and said, he asked a question to provoke some thought. How do you know you've been in the presence of God? It's a good question. And all the answers, when you boiled away all the verbiage and all the flowery language that was used to describe it, they all boiled down to the same answer. You can feel it. And his attitude and his response was, well, how do you know that wasn't the pizza you had last night? How do you know you've been in the presence of God? And after about a half an hour of the same response portrayed differently, the answer was really simple. You no longer see the world in the same way. You are changed. Nobody comes into the presence of God and walks away the same. It is simply impossible. You do not come into the presence of God and walk away the same individual. It is an absolute. There is a transforming power when you enter into the light of his presence. When his Holy Spirit fills you. And the neshama chaya, the breath of life, is once again breathed into you. Things change. Because your awareness changes. That servant was never the same after that experience of having his eyes opened and seeing the hills that surrounded Jerusalem, filled with the armies of God. He was never the same. He was always looking for God after that. You just know it. I have spoken on this more times than I can remember, but it is one of my core beliefs. We do not grasp God with our minds, irrespective of your capacity. You can be on a genius level. You can be profoundly retarded. It is irrelevant. God is not perceived in our minds because our minds are finite, regardless of your capacity. And the finite cannot apprehend the infinite. Well, we have symbols for it. It is necessary in advanced physics to have a concept of infinity, but we don't grasp that. We can't. The universe is expanding. Well, what's it expanding into? Nothingness. What do you mean nothingness? Nothingness is something then. It has to have a container. And within the brain, most brains will not fare well in theoretical physics, because we just cannot accept certain premises. They're not empirical. Many of them are simply not even conceivable. This is the essence of the day of Shavuot. God didn't call a people to believe one man that God came to. God came to this people, and God spoke. And the people responded, "We will." Now, we haven't always done well. In fact, the vast majority of our history, we have not done well. But our unfaithfulness has not affected God's faithfulness. And he will not do away with those whom he has called, because those callings are without revocation. They cannot be taken back. And thank God for that, really. Because without that little caveat, heaven be a right lonely place. There'd be nobody there. Because nobody is 100% faithful. Even Paul. I mean, at least, you know, although not many here have stuck the knife or the fork into the outlet, Paul did. I know it. He told me that in his letters. I wouldn't have known to covet except you said don't covet. I would never have stuck the fork in. It would never have occurred to me to stick the fork in the outlet until my mother said, don't stick the fork in the outlet. So I know if there were outlets, Paul stuck a fork in it. So at least I have some comfort knowing that I'm not the only profoundly retarded individual in the world. On this day, Shavuot, there has always been, it is the essence of the day, a more profound increase in the knowledge of God, which results in a new way of looking at this world. In my life, I became a believer in May of 1972, right around Shavuot. 5 years later, in the spring of 1977, right around Shavuot, I became baptized because I'm ornery and I could not figure out why I should be baptized. It took 5 years for the Lord to bring a man into my life who could speak a few simple words. And as soon as he was done speaking those words, okay, when can we do this? How about today after church? Good. I was ordained in May 1983. I became the rabbi of this congregation in the spring of 1985. I went to Israel for the first time, just prior to Shavuot. and my eyes were opened as to how I was to be a part of God's host, his army in Israel. On the very day of Shavuot, 1988, and as I remembered last week, I was installed as the General Secretary of the Union of Messianic Jewish Congregations. I was elected earlier, but I was installed in the spring. This season has always been a season of revelation, of increase in awareness and responsibility, because that always follows. When we are aware more, we are responsible for that awareness. Be filled with anticipation for what the Lord is going to show his body and you in particular in these latter days. The natural eye will see only the enemy. We are aware constantly of what the enemy, we are bombarded continually with what the enemy is doing. We see it every day on the news. We spend less time understanding what God is doing. The breath of life in you will give you heaven's eye, that we might see the hand of God moving in our lives, and heaven's ear, that we might hear his voice speaking to us, revealing the teacher behind us. Here's the path. Walk in this one. Don't go there. Go here. Absolutely essential in these days. My brother Jeff came back from Africa. The Lord is real busy. The Lord is working hard, overtime. He spoke a few words at a meeting in Sierra Leone. He thought he was going there to work with Ebola. God sent them there to work with the Word of Life. And after a single meeting, over 300 Muslims came to the Lord. And according to Bishop Solomon, who is over 26 different churches, and Bishop Solomon was a former Muslim himself who worked with Gaddafi for the Islamization of Northern Africa. And all of his 26 pastors under him were all former imams who were under him, and now the Lord got a hold of him, and through him got a hold of all of these imams. And they now have 26 different churches. Their testimony and the testimony of Alex Yalenga, daily, Muslims in Africa. God is winning in Africa. He's not faring as well in America. The Church of God is losing people in America, but God is winning souls in Africa. God is working. We just sometimes are blind to it, but it doesn't affect God at all. Our awareness of that is irrelevant to him. It is quite relevant to us. Have eyes to see and ears to hear, that you might behold the Lord our God and rejoice in all the things that he is doing this day, and pray that you could be a part. It is easy to work God into conversations. Speak about the one who came and died for you and gave you life, life more abundantly. It's easy to work God into conversations. Simple. How much is that? $22.54. Praise God. He just gave me $22.54. Let me tell you about my God who just gave me $22.50, whatever the, it doesn't matter. It's easy. Most of the time you will be seen as one of them. You'll be ridiculed. But then there's always that one that you'll get to kneel down with that day and pray to receive the word of life and another soul come into the kingdom. And the Lord will look down and go, well done, true, faithful servant. You have been faithful in few things. I will now give you charge over much. Enter into the rest of your Lord. Father, in Yeshua's name, honor and glory to you. Give us the boldness you had, that we might speak to every soul whom you bring us across, the word of life, to reveal a knowledge of the spoken word, of the one who speaks that word, of our Messiah, Mikor Chaim, the fountainhead of life. Lord, do this for the glory of your name, that we might hasten the time of your return, that we might finally behold your face in fullness and worship in Yeshua's precious name.